chapter 13, verses 10 to 17. On a Sabbath, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues, and a woman was there who had been crippled by a spirit for 18 years. She was bent over and could not straighten up at all. When Jesus saw her, he called her forward and said to her, "Woman, you are set free from your infirmity." Then he put his hands on her, and immediately she straightened up and praised God. Indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, the synagogue ruler said to the people, "There are 6 days for work, so come and be healed on those days, not on the Sabbath." The Lord answered him, "You hypocrites, doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out to give it water? Then should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath day from what bound her?" When he said this, all his opponents were humiliated, but the people were delighted with all the wonderful things he was doing.
Much for the wonderful privilege of having your word, having the records of Jesus' life and his interactions with people. Thank you for the wonderful privilege of hearing about it, and the responsibility and privilege for me to lead your people in that. May the thoughts of my mind, the words of my mouth, and what we say together today be acceptable to you, Lord God. Amen. I'm wondering if you recognise this person here. Does anybody put your hand up if you recognise that person there? Some of you do. A few do. You don't? Okay, terrific. I'm on safe ground then, aren't I? This is Dave Kendall. Dave Kendall was a Baptist minister, a Baptist pastor for many years, and worked at the Bible Society for a while. And it was my great privilege to know Dave, and I got to know him very well. And Dave had a great sense of humour, and he came and led a mission at a church that I was working at Wollongong. And it was very interesting that he was asked to lead this mission because the senior pastor at that church, Reg, was an old-style preacher. Every Sunday he would preach the gospel. He would tell the congregation that they were sinners. He would tell the congregation that they were going to go to hell unless they repented. Dave's emphasis, the big emphasis of his life, was God's not mad at you. God loves you and wants you to come back. And at some point, it kind of looked like these two things clashed. But yet, Reg was smart enough to know, this is my style and this is my emphasis, and I've been here 10 years, and so I need to get someone else in with a different emphasis to have a fresh approach. And they lined up to kind of together in their views theologically, but their approach in how they applied that and preached was vastly different. And it was during this mission that Dave and I one day were having coffee, and we were being silly, and we were getting carried away with humour, and we started talking about how the mission was going to be reported. And as we were talking about how the mission was going to be reported, in our silliness and frivolity in this particular time, we came up with evangelistic mathematics. And evangelistic mathematics works like this. If no one is converted, then we report that a great multitude were blessed. If one person becomes a Christian, then there was a harvest for the Lord. If two people become Christians, then in the marketing and reporting of the mission, we could say there were multiple conversions. And then we talked about how many people need to become Christians before we can use the dreaded R word, that revival's broken out. Now, it was a very frivolous and kind of silly kind of chat we had at that cup of coffee. But in some regards, that frivolous and silliness, but yet in a more serious sense, is the theme of this passage here in Luke's Gospel. And this passage here in Luke's Gospel in chapter 13 is a very unusual passage for Luke, because Luke is usually really big on detail. He's the historian. He was there with the apostles in the latter parts of Acts. But he wasn't there in the Gospel of Jesus, in the time when Jesus was walking in ministry. And so we read in the beginning of Luke's Gospel that he has researched thoroughly to present an orderly account. And if we compare this event here with, say, the encounter Jesus had with Zacchaeus, We know so much about Zacchaeus. We know the town, it was Jericho. We know his name. We know his occupation, he was a tax collector. We know his rank within that, that he was a chief tax collector. We know that physically he was short, and to try and see Jesus, he climbed a tree. And Luke tells us even the type of tree that he climbed, a sycamore fig tree. And so for the people of the day, as they heard that story being told again, or they read that in the gospel, it was like us hearing he climbed a jacaranda. And the picture in our mind is just there. Now, I don't know what a sycamore fig tree looks like. I could probably find a picture of one if I Googled it. But for those people, it meant so much. Here in this passage, it's very unlike Luke. We don't have the detail. It starts off with in a synagogue or one synagogue. It's just kind of so random. We don't know the name of the town. And so not knowing the name of the town, we obviously don't know where it is. So was this town close to Jerusalem and therefore close to the Pharisees and the priests' influence? Or was it close to the border of Israel and therefore close to the influence of the pagan nations around them? We don't know that. We don't know the woman's name. We don't know the ruler's name. There is so much here that we don't know. So let's turn our attention to what we do know. This woman has been crippled for 18 years, and it's not through a physical ailment, it's through an evil spirit. She's at the synagogue, so she's Jewish, and because she's at the synagogue, she's observant, maybe even devout. Jesus sees her, he's teaching, he sees her, he calls her, and he heals her. We don't know what Jesus' motivation was. We read earlier on in Luke 7 that Jesus goes to the town of Nain, and there he sees a widow who is at the funeral procession of her only son. Now, in an agricultural society, you needed a man to work the fields. You needed a man to be out working for you. That doesn't ring very true in today's society, but in that society, it was just the way it was. And so the readers of this story that Luke records would have known this lady is headed for abject poverty. She's a widow, burying her only son. She is going to have a destitute life, and probably in front of her, a good result for her would end up being a beggar, because she's probably going to end up being much worse. And we record it. Luke records that Jesus' heart went out to her. So we see the motivation there. We don't get the motivation here from Jesus at all. Jesus sees her, calls her forward, and in the calling her forward, there's no sense of, oh, would you please come forward because I'd like to heal you. There's no sense of that at all. Jesus sees her, calls her forward, he takes the initiative, she doesn't do anything. Unlike the lepers in Luke 17, where they cry out to Jesus to be healed, and Jesus gives them a task to do. And so in faith and obedience, they obey that task and go to the priest to show themselves, and along the way they notice that they've been healed. She doesn't do anything at all. Here this woman doesn't even stretch out her hand. When Jesus saw her, he called her forward. Woman, you are set free from your infirmity. Then he put his hand on her, and immediately she straightened up and praised God. We now turn our attention to the synagogue ruler. We've talked about we don't know his name and we don't know the location, so we don't know a little bit of the influences of his life. We don't know his attitude to Jesus. When Nicodemus comes to Jesus in John 3, we see that his inquiring of God, that he's inquiring of Jesus. He's not fully on board yet as a follower, but he's certainly not where the rest of the Pharisees are, completely against Jesus. He's actually genuinely open. We don't know whether this ruler has invited Jesus to teach because he's trying to trap him, as we see so often in the Gospels. We don't know whether it's just a rabbinic tradition, a courtesy. The new rabbi's come through, so let's allow him to preach. We don't know what his motivation is. What we do know is it is a synagogue ruler. And so that means he was probably in charge of 10 local synagogues in a country region. And those local synagogues, because everybody walked or maybe travelled by a donkey, were probably in a confined area, probably the size of the catchment for a local high school. So we know that about him. We also know that he fits in the tradition of the Pharisees and the Jewish rabbis because he was indignant. So indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. Now, indignant's a strong word, isn't it? And I was trying to find some times of when I was indignant of something that happened. And I actually thought of an incident in Dave Kendall's life, or rather at his funeral. Dave was buried, and that burial was a private ceremony just with his immediate family. So there was his casket at the funeral. We'd had the service, and afterwards we're having tea and coffee like we do at a funeral. The casket is taken to the hearse, and then an announcement comes over. Would car registration ABC123 please move your car because you've parked in the hearse? And I thought, is there any social faux pas left to break? And, you know, like, how late do you have to be going into a funeral to go, I'll just park there, you know? And it's not like you look at the hearse and go, oh, is it a station wagon, hearse, station, oh, I'm not sure, I'll just park here and take the risk. You know, like, I thought, what are you doing? But for me, it was more shock than indignation. Indignation is kind of going that step further and going, I'm really angry about this. This is just broken social convention. This just should not happen. And there's from the person, they feel it's a righteous anger, a righteous indignation. It's a strong word, isn't it? Indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, the synagogue ruler said to the people, and it's interesting that Jesus has done the healing, so if there's a law that's been broken, it's Jesus who's broken it. But who does he direct his anger at? The people. There are 6 days for work, so come and be healed on those days, not on the Sabbath. Now, at this point, it's important for us to ask, what's happening here? Has Jesus actually broken the Sabbath law? Because we have the Ten Commandments, and one of those commandments is, you know, respect the Sabbath. Has Jesus broken that, or is something else going on? Well, the nation of Israel took God's laws very seriously. They didn't want to break them. And so what they did is they set up a whole bunch of guidelines that became rules around them that ended up being what was known as the rabbinic tradition that was additional to the Old Testament to help them not break the Old Testament. And this actually did start with good motives. So what started is they set up a guardrail. Now, a guardrail is a device within the zone of safety to stop you going into a dangerous zone, like off a cliff, right? Guardrails are good things. I've never hit one, but I like them. And that then evolves into a rule, and then it got written down, and it becomes an obligation. Let's imagine you live down at Pennant Hills, and you have a gambling addiction. And between where you live and the railway station is the local TAB that's there at Pennant Hills. And so you decide to go the long way to the station so you never walk past it on the way to work or the way home from work. That's probably a good guardrail for you. And then your son or daughter starts to travel to university or work at a similar time to you, and so they come with you and you go, oh no, we don't go that way, we go this way. But then when you're not going with them, you insist that they follow your rule and they keep going the long way, not past the TAB. You've got a problem with it, but they don't. But you're implying a rule on them that they should obey. Can you see how these things kind of evolve? Now, in saying it that way, I've oversimplified it so much so, because they had all these rules written down. They had the law called the Halakha, which was preserved in a scroll or a book called the Mishnah. Now, on the Sabbath laws, on the Sabbath laws alone, in the Mishnah, they had 24 chapters, not 24 rules, 24 chapters. Now, I haven't read all of them. I don't have any desire to read all of them. I've read some of them in the commentaries. And the one that I like the best, because these rules quite often tied themselves in knots, is the one about eggs on the Sabbath. If you had hens, and the purpose of these hens over here were to lay eggs for you, and they dropped an egg for you on the Sabbath, you couldn't eat that egg. Right? That's not allowed. But if over here you had some hens, and the purpose of these hens was you were going to grow them up and fatten them for eating because you wanted a chicken dinner at some stage, and these hens just happened to drop an egg on the Sabbath, well, you could eat those ones. That was okay. Now, I'm not quite seeing the sense of that, but that's what you could do. And it was the same if someone got an injury. So if this afternoon I fall over and I have a big cut on my thigh here, I'll probably have to go to hospital. And not being medical, this analogy might limp a little, but I'd imagine the first thing they'll do is they'll clean it out, make sure there's nothing left in there to infect it so I don't get another infection. And if it's a deep cut, they'll stitch it, and then they'll bandage it. So there's three steps there. For someone who'd injured themselves on the Sabbath, they could only do enough to preserve life, and then they had to stop. They couldn't continue the process and finish that. So they might clean out my wound, right, so that further infection wouldn't come and I wouldn't die, but they wouldn't go the rest of the way and finish the bandaging. And so what Jesus has done here is he has gone past preserving life and he has gone to healing the person. And that, in this rabbinic tradition, in the Mishnah, has broken their laws. And Jesus ignores it. All of this religious stuff gets in the way of people connecting with God. Now, what's the key message of this passage? Well, there is a theme of Jesus' authority here. Jesus has authority over the spiritual realm. This lady's condition has been brought on by a spirit, and Jesus heals her physically, and so he defeats both of those. And this raises the question, who is Jesus? And so in the Gospels, we see Jesus having power and authority over the natural elements, power and authority over the spiritual realm, power and authority over the physical realm. And it's raising the question all the time, who is Jesus? And the gospel writers bring this to a crescendo in the resurrection, where they say he has power over death and life. He is the Son of God, the promised Messiah, the one we should follow. That's the message here. But there is also the message of Jesus' authority and mission. Jesus wants people to become followers of the true God. He doesn't want the synagogue rulers and the Pharisees to get in the way. True relationship with God has minimal rules, not extra rules put on from religion and religious leaders. The Pharisees had many rules, and Jesus just ignored them. Jesus just ignored these extra rules. And we see one time where Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat at his house, and he's reclining at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus didn't wash before the meal. Now, this is not Jesus has gone to the men's room and he hasn't washed his hands. That's not what's happened here. This is Jesus has not followed the proper Mishnah, rabbinical teaching, process for washing hands that the Jews thought they had to go through, that had got to the stage of becoming these obliged laws and rules. And Jesus knew what he was doing. He knew he was with a Pharisee. He knew he was at a Pharisee's home. He knew how the Pharisee thought. He knew he was going to be judged, and he actively chooses to ignore these rules. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed he didn't wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, remember those photos, meek and mild Jesus, drawings and paintings, meek and mild Jesus, he's there with a lamb, have you seen those? They're quite a distorted portrayal of Jesus, because this is one of the occasions when Jesus gets out his double barrel shotgun, gives them both barrels, cocks it, gets out the empty cartridges, reloads, gives it again. And the people he did this to were the religious leaders who put rules and barriers in the way of people knowing God. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give a tenth of your mint and rue and all other kinds of garden herbs. Now, you might take some of the produce of the market garden there. We have a bit of a garden at home. Kathy loves gardening. And occasionally when she's cooking, she'll go out and she'll grab some herbs or something. And if you're a strict Orthodox Jew, you would say, I've harvested this. This is my income. I'm going to grab a tenth of it and sacrifice and chuck it away. And that's what Jesus is referring to here. And all of it. But you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former. Woe to you because you load down people with a burden they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift a finger to help them. This isn't the picture of Jesus with a little lamb, is it? He's really giving it to them. And he reacts similarly here. Where are we now? sorry. We're off the grid. Well, that's okay. The Lord, so in here, the Lord answers him, "You hypocrites, didn't each of you on the Sabbath untie your ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out and give it water? Then you should, then should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham," and in saying a daughter of Abraham, he's saying to this synagogue ruler, "Let me invoke the covenant that God made to the nation of Israel with our great father Abraham, through whom all of us descend and have the covenantal promises of God." He's bringing her straight into that understanding. "Whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath." When he said all this, his opponents were humiliated, but the people were delighted. There's a lot of cynicism here, isn't there? There's a lot of condescension. The local synagogue ruler is cynical about Jesus. He's a Sabbath breaker, and he's condescending to the people. "Go away and come back on the other days." And there's some condescension from Jesus. He gives it to these people. Sometimes when that happens, it's quite harsh and we don't enjoy it. Other times when it happens, it's quite funny. The two characters from The Muppets, Statler and Waldorf, are probably the most well known for that, which are probably universally loved. Statler, "Do you believe in life after death?" Waldorf, "Every time I leave this theatre." Statler, "Does this show constitute cruelty to animals?" Waldorf, "Not unless you're watching it." Statler, "The internet is completely different culture, isn't it?" Waldorf, "You said it. Everything here is immediately followed by sarcastic comments and nasty responses." Statler, "Yep, we've finally found where we belong." Now we laugh at that and we love it. Sometimes it's got a place. What would the synagogue ruler have said when he got home? Would he have changed his heart and mind and gone, "Wow, you're right. I got that wrong. I should get on board with Jesus"? Or would he have been too embedded in that rabbinic tradition, in the Pharisees' way of judging Jesus for breaking their law? Would he have been cynical or patronizing to Jesus when he got home?
Well, Jesus, the recently famous rabbi, showed up and was teaching.
That's nice.
No, it wasn't. You know what he did? He went ahead and healed someone. Right there and then, in front of everyone on the Sabbath. You know, this lady, 18 years bent over, without a hope of ever straightening up, and he goes and heals her on the Sabbath. The height of the man. And he calls himself a rabbi.
Oh my. What happened then?
Well, I could see that everyone was going to clamor for their own healing. So I told them, "There are 6 days for work. So come on any of those days and be healed, but not on the Sabbath." I had to put them in their place.
You're right, dear. You're right.
Not really. You know what Jesus did? He told me off. Me. Good and proper. And everyone was smirking and laughing. He made me look like a fool. But you know, if he doesn't know the Sabbath laws, he's no rabbi.
Thank you very much, guys. We don't know exactly how this Jewish ruler reacted. It's just surmising at this point. But I'd imagine that sort of portrayal is probably typical of what happened when he got home. His indignation would have carried on and would have continued. Well, how do we apply this to us? Well, we enjoy a cynical view of the world sometimes. We enjoy our evangelistic mathematics and when we can mention the R word. We enjoy Statler and Waldorf, and we enjoy it when it's delivered well. In fact, one of the best times that I've seen some sarcasm or condescension delivered the best, I was on the receiving end of it. As a young preacher, I had to preach on love, and it's always an awkward sermon. I don't feel any personal awkwardness today, But when you're preaching on love, you've got to give examples and you pick them from your life and you're saying to people, this is how you love. And it's always a bit, oh, I just feel personally awkward about that. But Kathy loves gardening. And when we first got married, we lived in a house that had terrible soil. And so I actually did do this. I dug a trench out the front of our house where the garden was, about 4 or 5 metres long, 3/4 of a metre wide, and about 0.5 metre deep, most of it through solid clay. And I trucked this out and took it to the tip and dumped it, and we had proper soil laid in so Kathy could have somewhere to garden where things would grow. So I did this probably in the first or second year of marriage. And then we moved, and I was at this church, and I had to preach on love, and I used this as an example of love. And after the service, a man came up and delivered the best condescension I've ever seen. And all the power dynamics were going in his way. It was an older man to a younger man. It was a more experienced man who'd been married for probably 50 years to a man who'd been married about 2.5 years. And it was a bigger man and a broader man, taller and broader man, to a shorter and narrower man. And he came up to me and he put his arm around me. He goes, Adrian, pat, pat, pat. You know when you gave that example of love of digging the trench for your wife? And I looked up at him and said, yeah. He said, that wasn't an illustration of love. All you did was illustrate that you're a newlywed. And then he walks off. There's no comeback for that. You know? There's no reply that can get me out of jail. It was just beautifully done and executed. And we laugh and enjoy it because sometimes it can be funny. But sometimes in churches, there are Statlers and Waldorfs. Wikipedia says Statler and Waldorf are a pair of Muppet characters known for their cantankerous opinions and shared penchant for heckling. The two elderly gentlemen first appeared on The Muppet Show in 1975, where they consistently jeered the entire cast and their performances from their balcony seats. Have you ever been to church with some Statlers and Waldorfs? Now, that's not to say we should blindly follow everything that our pastors do. We're in the great Protestant tradition of about 500 years old that puts the Bible in people's hands. We started schools to teach people to read so they could read the Bible for themselves and interpret it themselves. Our pastors and our elders and our teachers help us in that, but we should always have a mind that's open and evaluative and working things through. Jesus has a plan. Let's save the world. The Jews got in the way with their rules. And when Jesus didn't comply with them, he just cut through it so he could reach people. And he said, damn the consequences. I don't care whether they judge me. Now, Andrew recently has floated the goal that our church have a goal of being having 200 people become followers of Jesus by 2025. Is this where the Statlers and Waldorfs come in? Is this where, like the synagogue ruler, there's some cynicism at home? Oh, he's young and has big dreams. I think that's why Andrew likes me to preach. I make him look young, you know. It gets me up for that reason. Oh, he's a blow in these senior pastors. They're only here forever, 15 years. Maybe the things will go on. Now, Andrew and the elders and the deacons haven't fully worked it through, but it's an interesting goal for our church because we have a great children's program. We have a great preschool program. We have a great Sunday school. We have a fantastic girls' brigade and boys' brigade. And as I was thinking about this, I was actually thinking of Liam when he was at Anchor Boys and he got his boys' brigade Anchor Boy shirt and the badges, and I pick him up and he's in the car. Dad, I've got my boys' brigade shirt and I've got the badges. This is really important. We've got to get Grandma to sew them on. You know, like, we can't trust this with Mum, you know. Grandma had a sewing room and Grandma and our family, like, we can't trust this with Mum. We've got to go to the top. This is so important. And in his eyes as a second-class kid, it was how he saw it. It was beautiful. And he was saying, I appreciate this church. I appreciate Boys Brigade. I appreciate Anchor Boys. We've got a great high school program. We've got a great young adults program. Do you know one of the hardest things that it is to do in a church? It's to start a youth program if you've got 4 or 5 kids. What we have here at TCBC is momentum. And I would guess that by 2025, we would see 200 people through that youth program become Christians. Now, you don't need to listen to me on the goals for the church, because I'm not a pastor, I'm not an elder, I'm not a deacon, I'm just a loose cannon throwing darts at dartboard, seeing what sticks. And you can go home and you can be cynical and you can be Waldorf and Statler with me. But let me throw something out. I think if we're going to have that goal, maybe it'd be good to split it and to have 150 through our youth program and 50 for people above 25. What would that look like? Now, if we take out the people below 25, we've probably got 400 adults praying for, socialising, caring and speaking about Jesus with people. Way back in 2011, I think was the last time this church did the National Church Life Census, and it's lined up with the Australian Bureau Statistics census that comes out. And so it classifies people over 15. And for people over 15, TCBC's conversion rate is 3%. Now, when we take into consideration we've still got high school and young adults who are at that stage in their life where they're thinking about Jesus and becoming Christian, our conversion rate for people over 25, and this is old data now, so it may well have changed. It may well have changed. But our conversion rate for people over 25 is probably much lower than that. So what's the reputation of this church? Well, apparently we're one of the biggest Baptist churches in New South Wales. We've got a reputation for being very godly. We've got a reputation, I hear, occasionally for social justice and mission and lots of things. It's a good reputation. But are we a church that converts adults? And I think we've got to conclude, if we look at the data and if that data is still valid, that we're not. So what would it take for TCBC to be a church where 50 people over 25 became Christians in the next 7 years? That's only 7 a year, and 1 year we just got to work a little bit harder and get 8. Now, I'd guess there might be a strategy of connecting with people and praying and other things like that, but I'd imagine also that would mean that once we look at our programs and the way our church is structured and what we do, that some things would have to change. What they are, I don't know. What they are, I don't have an agenda for. I'm just throwing that out generally. And the question from this passage that's asked of us is, how do we react? Because we have a process, we have systems, we have things that we've built up. Just like the synagogue ruler had his systems of his Mishnah and the Jewish tradition that they held so tightly that got in the way of people becoming followers of God. So if our pastors, elders and deacons said, we need to do things in a way that doesn't inhibit people becoming followers of God, how would you react? And I think given that we don't have so much detail on this passage, we just have the emphasis on the indignation of the synagogue ruler, that this is the priority for us, to make it easy for people to become followers of Jesus. Let's pray.